Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Jessica from Syosset Public Library's podcast, and our guest today is...
My name is Lorenzo Carcaterra. I've been a professional writer since I think I was 18, actually. I've written books since 1990. This new one is my 12th. I get confused because I just finished one. Yeah, 12th. mostly I write thrillers and action novels and mysteries, but this one is a nonfiction book called Three Dreamers. It's about my mom, my Italian grandmother, and my late wife, Susan, who passed away on Christmas Eve, 2013, and how each in their own unique way, as in the case of my grandmother, my mother unknowingly led me to become a writer. And so I've had a long career, and I've waited a long time, actually, to write this book. I've been lucky enough to have a long career. I used to be a writer. I write scripts and movies as well. I was a writer-producer for Law & Order for a few years. Anyway, so this book means a lot to me because as I was writing it and I was talking about it with friends, it made them realize or think about the women in their own lives and how they've influenced them. And I think that's something men don't usually do as a rule. And I mean, they think about it, but they just don't kind of talk about it.
Right, yeah.
And I think that's an important thing, which I didn't think about it when I first came up with the idea for the book, but It did come out of the, during the process of the writing, it came up quite often in conversations with other men.
So I read the book very quickly and I devoured the stories. They were beautiful. They made me cry. Every woman you talked about, you know, there were layers and everything was a little complicated and human and wonderful. I am actually a huge consumer of thrillers and that type of literature as well. So the funny thing for me is that I don't read many stories like this, especially lately, pandemic. My attention is held by these outrageous, crazy things that happen in these thriller stories that one would hope would never happen in real life. But this one was almost like a meditation. It was just like a nice breath to kind of take and reflect. And I think it's going to be a really personal read for, I think, a lot of people, especially since, I mean, it's sad to say a lot of people have lost dreamers in their own life this last year. So when did you start writing this book?
I think I was in the middle of one of my novels. So that would be around, where are we now, 2020? I mean, this last year is a blur. I don't even know what day it is sometimes.
Yeah, I don't know if 2020 actually happened sometimes. Yeah, I think it was an imagination.
It was in 2019. And originally I was going to write it on spec, just write it. And my agent said, you know what, why don't you do an outline? I don't, as a rule, outline. I've been very lucky in my career from book one on, I think I've done one outline and prior to Three Dreamers. But she said, you know, put it down on paper. And the truth is, because my outlines for books are kind of bad. I just don't know what I'm going to do until I do it. So it's hard for me. I mean, I know, like in general, where how my stories in my mind are going to begin and stuff like that. But things just kind of catch you by surprise as you're writing. So anyway, I did do the outline. I wrote 30 pages in a day, which for me was, you know, quite a lot. And it just came, it just flowed out. She came back with some notes. And I devoted another day and it was 35 pages. And sure enough, she sold it off the outline. And I'm very glad I did do the outline because I pretty much have followed it. I mean, the outline really broke down exactly how I wanted to do the book. So it made it very clear in my head how to approach it, how to write it. Because again, since you've read it, it's three very different women. I mean, you know, Nona was one thing. My mother was, had this whole tragic life. And then Susan was the only non-Italian of the three. And we had to bring her in. what's interesting, what I found interesting, the section I thought would be the easiest to write proved to be the most difficult, which was Nona.
And the really?
Section, yeah,
really?
I thought would be the most difficult proved the easiest, which was Susan. And the reason I think behind the Susan thing, because it allowed me to go back to our early days and that kind of, you know, the early stages of friendship and romance and all of that and the laughs we had. And you know, so I knew the latter part when she got sick would be difficult, but Nona surprised me. I was really taken aback how hard it was. And maybe because it was broken up over seven summers. And maybe I just wanted to do just get, it was so much important to me to get her personality and that person she was across that I put maybe a little extra weight on my shoulders about it.
So you spent seven summers with her.
Right. Well, I was 14 and my family's from the island of Ischia, which is 18 miles off the coast of Naples. Beautiful island, big island. Now it's been, back then, this is 1968, 69. Back then, the only tourists were Germans, British, and Northern Italians. So many summers, I never saw an American. And luckily I spoke the dialect because my mother never spoke English. So I knew how to speak the dialect. And so I fell in love with Ischia as soon as I saw it. It was one of those places, I got off the boat and I just felt like this is where I belong. This is, you know, this is where I just didn't feel like I'm a visitor. I felt like this was home.
Right.
And I still feel that way. Then I meet, only heard about Nona. And all I had heard about is, you know, she wore the widow's black, which she did for every day that since my grandfather died. But that she was a very private person. She didn't really talk much. But what I saw was the Nona that was, she was very funny. She told great stories. She was very, she was private in the sense that, for example, she would never ask you a personal question. But by the same token, she would not want to be asked a personal question. Because she always felt your business is your business and my business is my business.
Very, very respectful, by the way. I have to say, very respectful. And I loved, there was an anecdote in the book where somebody asked what you had for dinner that night. And I'm not going to give it away because it's a segment to be, even though it's very short, to be, I think, enjoyed. But I really, really liked how she went about it. And then when you asked her about that, her answer, it was beautiful.
Yeah, it was whole, you know, and I didn't know. I mean, the stories I found out later about her or during those summers about World War II and running the black, you know, running to Naples every day. And this is years before, decades before the hydrofoil got you there in 25 minutes. The first year I went there, the boat took 90 minutes to get to the island. So just imagine during World War II, 90 minutes to Naples, not knowing if you're going to find food or bread or milk or whatever. And then 90 minutes late at night back before the curfew, the island was occupied by the Nazis. So before the curfew, and then you had to sneak the bread or the milk or whatever you ended up getting to your home. So, and then, you know, losing a son at night in the war, he was 19. My mother lost her husband and a 6-month-old baby in the war. So the war was very much, my mother kept the war very much alive. Grandma just kept it as a part of my life. It's not something that I'm going to talk about at length. Now, if you asked her, you know, you have to kind of, you know, dig around asking her, you know, say, no, who's that in the photo? And then a story would merge. But if you asked her, I never asked her directly about the war. But there were things I noticed that she did without having to tell me. There were only two big photos in the house, in those, and they were those old wooden frame photos that, you know, were popular in the 30s and 40s. So I knew one was my grandfather and one I found out later was my uncle who died in the war. But I noticed Nona always sat across from the photo of my grandfather. And always, so that was almost as if they were eating dinner together, which one of my aunts told me, which is different than say the way I raised my kids. We all ate as a family. My grandmother would feed the six kids together. And then she and my grandfather would eat alone. And that was their time together. So it was a love affair from day one to the day he died. But I, so again, she sat across from the table. And I wish I had put this in the book. My cousin pointed it out to me after I finished it. When she died, she was laying on the couch and she was looking up at his photo. So it was almost as if he never left, you know, that he was always a presence. In fact, he's a presence in my life. I've never met him. He died in August of 54. I was born in October 54. But he was always, and you know, you got a lot of free stuff because of him, because he had helped so many people. When I was a kid, I mean, my cousin and I would stop at his La Dolce Sosta, his great ice cream gelato place in Ischia. And early on, we went there, and the guy looked at me. He said, "Are you a Carcateri?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You related to Gabriel?" I said, "He's my grandfather." He gave me a free ice cream. So Paolo and I walked away. I said, "What is that all about? Why did I get a free ice cream?" He said, "Because Nono lent him the money to open this business." And so I just fell in love with the people. It's a great island. It says now it's this, well, not during a pandemic, but prior to the pandemic, it was a huge tourist place. And Americans now have discovered it, because I was there in 2019 and it was packed with Americans, which, you know, it's okay, I guess.
Yeah, very, very different. I mean, I feel like when I was reading the book, it was almost like I was a party to each summer. And it was just, it was really just a great read. And, you know, you talk a little bit, which dovetails very well into the story of your mother, how your mother visited, but it wasn't for a long time. And there were other stresses going on at home. So you were almost separate to them, but they were sort of like a cloud waiting to come. Yeah.
My parents' marriage was, I mean, I guess the word is horrible. I mean, it was an arranged marriage. They shouldn't have married. I have no idea why they did. I mean, I've heard different things, but none of it made any sense. They were two strangers who just met and married. And from day one, you know, my mother came here not speaking a word of English, and for 35 years never learned a word of English. So I used to get angry at that as I got older, because I think she made herself a victim. You know, she could have learned the language, she could have gotten a job, she could have helped out, but she was so dependent on my father and then on me as well that, but, you know, maybe at some point, that, you know, she had been previously married, her husband died, her son died, that you get so beaten down that you just say, you know what good does it do for me to keep achieving or trying to get to the next level? It's just futile. And so a lot of her stuff, as you know from the book, was very negative toward me. But there were a lot of positives as well. I think one of the biggest positives was taking me on Sundays to those Italian war movies. Usually they were war movies. And that had a big influence on me, because, you know, if you grew up in New York and you watched, you know, American television, it was usually with John Wayne, who was 45 when the average GI was 19.
Yeah.
And the Italians always were running or betraying or surrendering. But here, watching those movies with her and with all these other older Italian women who are always crying through the movie, you see the films of De Sica and Rossellini, you see the real effect of a war that it had on these people. And then afterwards, they would sit around and drink espresso and talk until. So for me, I always have been, I loved to be in the company of storytellers when I was a kid, because I just love listening to great stories. And Nona was a great storyteller, and my mother was, in her own way, a terrific storyteller. And so she opened a world to me that she was more willing to talk about the war than Nona was. And so despite her, you know, I used to hear from her sisters that my mother was this, when she was young, played all these practical jokes and was the, you know, she was the clownish sister, the one always looking for the laugh. I never met that woman. Yeah. By the time I met her, she was, that part of her had been demolished, I guess. And I'm glad, you know, I'm glad I wrote it, because it made my peace with her. I mean, I was angry at her for a number of years for a lot of different silly reasons now, but writing it, it kind of hits you that, you know what, she did the best she could under the conditions that she was living in.
Yeah. And when she sent you to your family in Ischia, you know, it was, it seemed like almost a way, and please forgive me if I'm wrong, to help you escape what she was or what had become of her. And even though you never met that woman, you met people who knew that woman. And by, even though there's no substitute for that, but she knew it was what you really, really needed. And it almost seems like it was like a rescue, the best that she could possibly do at that moment.
Yeah, she did do her best. And, you know, and keep in mind, she was working in a vacuum. Both she and Nona didn't have any, we didn't have books in the house. They never read news. My mother read the religious pamphlets. She was very religious. So, you know, she knew about all the saints and all of that. But, you know, as far as reading novels or newspapers, except for the Italian language paper, she didn't. But Nona read nothing, as far as I know. And so to tell them you wanted to be a writer, to them is, yeah, I could, might as well say I want to be an astronaut. I mean, they had no clue what that meant. But it didn't prevent them from, in their own way, encouraging or discouraging you. They just said, all right, this is what he wants to do. Let's do it. I mean, my grandmother was a very sharp, very smart businesswoman. But other than the trips to Naples for the black market, she was an island woman. She never left the island. There were certain words in Italian, which are in dialect, that she would not know. And there were certain things. One of my aunts married, my uncle Benny was the head of the Italian paratroopers, and they were based in Pisa. So when they were engaged, a couple of women went up to Nona and said, what does Nancy's husband do for a living? And Nona, not knowing what a paratrooper is, said, he throws himself out of planes. I don't know why, but they pay him. And then my other uncle, who married her daughter Anna, was, because they both had been, both my uncles were prisoners of war for 7 years. My uncle married Anna, Uncle Neri, became one of the heads of the Italian railroad. Again, someone asked Nona what he did, and she said he rides trains. he just goes back and forth on a train. And to her, that was as simple as, you know, he got a job. This is his job. He's on a train and he gets paid. And he loves my daughter. So what more do you want? So they were simple. She was a simple person. So she just kept everything. I think the story that sets that up in the book is when somebody says, so-and-so is marrying somebody who I think is a prostitute.
A prostitute.
And my grandmother didn't know that word. She knew the dialect word.
Right.
So she said, you know what? What's important is that she doesn't smoke. And she walked away. And later they turned out both were wrong, that she was a Protestant.
Yes. So your mother was religious, but your grandmother was not. And you mentioned that she spent a lot of time outside of the church, and she expected to return to the church when she passes away. But that's very interesting.
Especially on that island. It's very, I mean, people go to mass. I have a cousin who goes to mass every morning at 9 a.m. And a lot of the relatives do. So Nona was never part of that. She just saw it as a place where you sit down and 10 minutes later, somebody's passing out, you got to give them money. And so she said, you know, I'm better off. She sat in front of the church. She loved sitting in front of the church. But she just, it was not anti-religion or anti, she just didn't see it as an important part of her life. You know, my mother would say the rosary every day. Some of my aunts did. Nona never did. And, I guarantee you, she couldn't tell you the name of the Pope. And, which is rare. Ischia is one of those islands that every 200 feet, there's a church. So you can't like avoid it, but she did. She just said, you know, this is not what I, a lot of it, I think had to do, well, not a lot, but a portion of it had to do A, with her own personality, but B, because my grandfather died at a very young age. And I think she was burned by that without saying so. And when her son died in the war, the very first person to bring them the flag and the remains was a priest. So I think these kind of symbols, the military people were behind the priest, but it was the priest who had all the effects, his last effects of him, his clothes or whatever was left. And she just, so she losing this, I think losing people affected her in a different way. Losing people with my mother made her more religious. And I think losing people made Nona pull back a bit from, this is not what I want. And
Yeah. So one of the things you talk about, and it's the subject of your first book, is that your father was not a good person. Is that okay to say?
Yeah, you know, to me, he was it's given what you know about him. And to me, he was a good father up to a point. You know, he himself was a gifted storyteller. So the stories about gangsters and the mob and all of that stuff, which I've written about, came from him. Boxing, sports were important to him. But he was a very violent guy, and he did 7.5 years in prison for murder and second degree manslaughter. And he was very violent to my mother. And for many years, who were younger than me were getting their own apartments and things like that. I felt I couldn't do that for a long time because I just felt if I left them alone, one of the issues with going to Eastgate every summer, which, you know, I was helping out my uncle. So I was making money when I was working there. They had a big tourist business, but leaving her alone for X number of weeks or months for me was great. But I always wondered for her, it left him under his domain, I guess, his clutches. And he was very vicious to her. But there were moments, you know, I mean, I was growing up thinking I will never marry. Because again, they were not unique in fighting all the time because the neighborhood was filled with couples who fought vicious. I mean, the walls were paper thin, so you knew everything that was going on.
Right.
Second, a lot of the men cheated on their wives. So again, he wasn't that, you know.
That I guess was somewhat common, that it was expected almost.
Yeah, in those neighborhoods. He was a gambler, but a lot of the guys gambled. And he was, you know, it was a kind of a small-time con guy, and a lot of the guys were. So again, and he was physical with me and my mother. But a lot of my friends, their dad was physical with them. So it was not like, it's just me. But the thing that used to bother me the most is like about 4:30, 5 o'clock, they would get into this vicious fight with plates being tossed and pots and punches, and you're in the middle of it. And then like 2 hours later, they're sitting and watching television, sharing a bowl of pretzels, and you're going like, what is it me? I mean, what is wrong with this?
Right.
I mean, this is not normal. And I definitely want no part of this, you know, and until Iskis showed me the other side, because my aunts and uncles were happily married. You know, very few of them were well off. They were working class, but they just seemed to enjoy each other's company. Nobody beat each other up. Nobody threw a plate. Nobody punched each other. My uncles weren't gambling away their salaries or anything like that. They were all about family and having a good time and laughing and loving each other. So that opened another window to me that, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be the way it is back there.
Yeah. And your mother, that was like, seems like what she wanted to show you.
Yeah, it was important for me to go to Iskia. And I mean, initially I balked at it. You know, I was 14. I wanted to hang out with my friends in New York, you know, this island I'd never heard of. Why am I going there? I don't know these people. They don't know me. And I thought they would hate me. And then when I'm stuck there for three, you know, you don't go for 2 days. They booked me for 3.5 months, $68 round trip flight. And again, everything was rigged in that neighborhood. We posed, and I didn't know any of these people. We posed in front of this large banner of a club that none of us belonged to, pretending that we belonged to it and got on the plane. But again, like I said, the minute I got there, not only did I make close friends that I have to this very day, and relatives that, you know, sadly, many of them have passed on, but I really got close to my mom's family. My aunt Frances was like a mother to me. And I loved being with her. I never left her presence without laughing. You know, she was just one of those kind of exuberant. I remember when she was on her last months of life, she was bedridden, and I would spend an afternoon at her house and she liked to watch afternoon TV, and she loved Chuck Norris, Texas Ranger, or Walker, Texas Ranger. And she believed it. It wasn't like it was a TV series.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You
know, 20 minutes into it, she'd nudge me and she'd say, I know it looks bad for him, but he's going to work it out.
That actually brings me to something. So you talk about being a fan of wrestling.
Yes.
Yeah. So that makes me laugh because the only grandfather I knew from my paternal side was a huge fan of professional wrestling. And like you were saying, he believed that all of it, that there was no choreography. It was not staged. Andre the Giant is definitely jumping on that guy's face. And you could not tell him otherwise.
No, they did believe it. And, you know, it became theater for poor people. I mean, first of all, it was on TV a lot.
Yeah.
And second, they weren't like these muscle-bound guys that you see today. They were, they were big. But and what they were smart about, the wrestling organizations, they broke it up over ethnic lines. The Italians had their guy. The Irish guys had theirs. The Germans had theirs. The Hispanic had theirs. So everybody had somebody to root for. And all the villains, you know, none of them came from. I remember there was a wrestler named Baron Mikhail Cicluna. They would announce him from the island of Malta, and he wore a cape, and everyone, ooh. Turned out he was like from Syracuse or Pittsburgh or something. Bruno Sammartino was from Pittsburgh. So, but all, you know, they all, we'd right. go to the garden. The old garden was a couple of blocks from where we lived, and it cost $6 and you got a great seat, and it was 4 hours of pure entertainment for them. And I think it was you know what, when you're living a day-to-day life where every nickel counts, you need that kind of release every once in a while. So yes, I would, you know, I'd look at them, and you could see in the ring they were missing each other by inches and making a thud with their hands or whatever.
Right.
Mom, this is not real. These guys, they'd be dead if they hit each other like this with a chair and, you know.
Yeah.
And she said, no. This is real. Just pay attention. And so, yeah, it was a fun thing. And, you know, my son got into it when he was younger, and I encouraged that, you know. And
so this is a question that I am very excited to ask you, and it kind of brings us into the story of your wife, Susan, who is the third dreamer in right. your book. So is it true that your son was instrumental in having Dwayne The Rock Johnson be one of the most 50 beautiful people?
Yes, he pursued The Rock, and he was right. He's now a major movie star.
Oh my God, I would have never guessed. I mean, I remember back in the day when he was, you know, jabroni and whatever it was that he said all the time. And now I just, like, I love him, and everybody loves him.
My son is convinced he's going to be president one day.
I heard that's like the premise of his current TV show. So.
Yeah, they want him to run for president. But Nick put, you know, Nick was very, very movie conscious and very into wrestling at a very young age. And he never gave up. He kept saying to Susan, this guy's big, Mom, this guy's huge. And finally, Susan, you know, started watch some of the wrestling, and he is charismatic, and said, well, okay. And brought Nick to the photo shoot, which for Nick was like, you know, meeting.
That Elvis. Sounds amazing.
Yeah. And so you know, when The Rock went over to thank Susan for including him, she said, well, you don't need to thank me, you need to thank him. And he said, my man. So he hung out with Nick all day. It was like heaven. He also got Stone Cold Steve Austin into some other photo shoot and hung out with him for it. So Nick's whole plan was to
hang out with all of the cool wrestlers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So tell us about meeting your wife, because it kind of coincides with the point where you decide you're going to leave home, right?
Yeah, I was working at the Daily. We both were at the New York Daily News, except I was on the in the coal mines, and she was an editor. I was working my way up, and I was doing these jobs. You hate copy boy, which no longer exists, sadly. Copy boy, and then movie timetable clerk. She was an editor, and I got to know her by suggesting an article to her, and she let me write it without assigning it. She assigned it on spec, sort of, because she didn't know me. She didn't know if I could write. And so out of that grew a friendship, and out of the friendship grew love. The problem with us, it wasn't a problem for us, it was a problem at the paper at the time. She was also my editor, because I then got promoted. And it was also frowned upon that, reporters marry their editor. I remember Pete Hamill telling me, I know a good editor is hard to find, but God, you got to marry one. it was a marriage that shouldn't have happened, but for whatever reason, it worked for a long, long time. And, like any long-term marriage, obviously we had our ups and downs, but it was, like I've said many times, I miss my wife very much, but I miss my best friend even more. And I miss the little things. I'm at my desk now. She would, in the mornings, she read everything. She saw everything. She was just amazing in that sense. And she was a great editor on top of it, but she would leave me clippings. This might be good for a script. This might be good for a book. You might use this on something. So my desk was littered with these little cutout things. And I would put them in different folders, and I've used many of them. And that I do miss. There's still a temptation to come to my desk in the morning, and not see that. That was one of the good points about writing this book. It kind of, they've always been alive to me in my mind, but writing it was like they were here with me, Susan was always my first read on all the books and the scripts. And not so much the scripts. She liked to watch the scripts when they aired, but not so much the editing of them. But only because she knew they would go through so many changes by the time he got them on air.
Yeah.
But the book, she was the, always remember when I gave her the pages that were ready to be shipped to my editor, she would have two pencils ready. And I would always say, well, why do you think you need a pencil? Maybe it's really good and don't need to change a thing. She goes, I don't think so. And she always made it better, and that I miss as well. And I've been very fortunate to have good editors throughout my career, my writing career, but she was probably the best one. And her belief in me was very, just beyond anything I could imagine. I didn't have the belief in me that she had. So, I guess I owe a lot to her, and I know I owe. Plus, she gave me two great kids, and one of whom just gave me a great grandson.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Maybe another storyteller?
I hope so. He's a live wire. He's a year and 4 months. He was born, unfortunately, in December, and then the pandemic hit in March.
Yeah.
But now that I've had COVID in December and two vaccines, I can hang out with him, I think. I hope. And but she sends me, a lot of video on him, and it's nice. And again, you wish that, my wife had been here to see him. It would have been a great moment for her, a great time. And for Nona to know him. I mean, Nona loved little kids, small kids. They were always maybe because she had a apron full of candies, I don't know, but
right.
They clustered around her. And she found, she liked animals and kids more than anything, I think. And because she saw the innocence in both, and whereas she saw the two sides of grownups, the good and the bad.
I don't think I really asked, why did you decide that this was the right time to write this book?
I think I hit the right age. I'm 66. It just dawned on me, if I didn't do it now, when was I going to do it? And then, and my initial thought was no one would care. Initially, after Susan died, a year after Susan died, I was asked to do like a cancer memoir thing. But, there's so many really good ones out there, and we all know how sadly they end. And I just didn't want to be one of another.
Right.
Two. And
yeah.
I couldn't do a better job than some of the ones I'd read. So I passed on that. The next idea was the history of a marriage from beginning to end, with strengths and weaknesses and all, wars and good times and bad times. And again, that didn't appeal to me either. But then I hit on this, on the link between these three very special women in my life. And I said, maybe there's something here that we could play with. And luckily my agent thought so too. And thankfully the publisher did as well. And I have to say, it was a pleasure I thought it would be a depressing book to work on, to be honest. And it was not. It was, I was very eager to get to the computer each morning and, tell their story. And I hope people respond to their story, like as you seem to have. And I think we all have those kind of women in our lives. And sometimes, you know, we always think about them, we just don't think about them in a way that enough to talk about them, like to keep them alive. It was a great way to keep them alive. And I thought, you know, if nothing else, if this book doesn't sell one single copy, it'll be there for my kids to read and my grandson to read and my family to look at. And so in that sense, I hope I've done the three ladies justice.
I think so. I think it's going to have a very big audience. I can tell you, I know a lot of people, at least, I know a lot of people in the library who are going to love it, which as people who love books and love to recommend books, I think that the greater public is going to as well.
I hope so. That would be a nice, that's the icing on the cake, that it gets out to a bigger audience. The actual, you write it for yourself and you hope somebody out there says, oh, I like this. And, you know, it helped me. If it makes them even just for a few moments or a day or two, think about somebody important in their lives that helped them. You know, everybody's helped us. Somebody's helped you get to your way and find your way. And somebody's, three of them helped me find my way. And, you know, we can't get anywhere without any help, especially in this time in this country when there seems to be such anger and discord, which is very unsettling, especially when you're my age. And now you have a grandson to worry about. And I won't be around to see him, you know, in his 20s and 30s. But I think it's nice to pull back a little and say, you know, let's look at the good things. And it was a nice break from my previous books where everybody, you know, shoots each other and somebody dies, usually the bad guy thankfully dies. But so this was a nice change of pace, and it made me want to do some more stuff. I just don't know of anybody else who's impacted my life the way these three women have.
Maybe it'll just take some time to figure that out. So what are you working on at the moment?
I'm on the second draft of a novel, which will be published, I believe, this time next year. So my publisher and my editor were so taken with Nona Maria from Three Dreamers that they approached me and asked if I would make her a fictional character and have her solve crimes on the island of Ischia.
I love it. That's awesome.
So at first I said, you know, I said, let me think about it. Because, you know, the deep, dark secret about that is there is no crime on the island of Ischia. But I said, let me play around with it. And it turned out I had a great time. My editor loves the first draft. The second draft has been a pleasure to work on. The title is, they give it an old school title. They're going to do like an old, you know how they those covers from the mystery novels of the 30s were like, always illustrated? And,
yeah.
So they're going to do that. And it's called Nona Maria and the Case of the Missing Bride. And now they want to do a series. I said, man, I mean, it was hard enough coming up with, you know, two crimes. You know, nothing happens at Ischia. I mean, the Katabaneri love being sent to Ischia because, you know, it means getting a suntan and having a Campari and soda all day. Occasionally, they'll run the siren just to make a noise. But anyway, so that was their idea. And you know, we'll see how Nona Maria, maybe this time next year, we'll be talking about Nona Maria, the detective.
I was going to say, I have an open invitation for you to come back and tell us all about that. And then, of course, the subsequent Netflix series.
Well, yeah.
Where you get to cast Nona Maria.
Well, the Italians are ready. The Italian company called, you know, they get wind of these books before anybody seems to get wind of them. And, you know, the obvious person is Sophia Loren because she's from that area. She's from Pozzuoli, which is two islands over. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, that's thinking ahead a bit. But I had a great time writing Nona Maria. I'm having a great time on the second draft. She's a cool detective. She is exactly the way her personality is in the real personality. You know, she's not Miss Marple because she's, where's the widow's black? I mean, my impression was Miss Marple drinks only tea.
Right.
Maria drinks a lot of wine and a lot of coffee. And it was married. Miss Marple obviously was not. So she just handles it. She has connections all over the island. She works with the Carabinieri, and she, in this particular book, helps solve two cases.
That's great. Cannot wait to read that one and talk to you about it.
I hope so. They said it's going to open a whole new audience for me. I have no idea who that audience is, but let's see where we go with it.
Just embrace them.
I will. If you love Nonna Maria, that's all I ask. That's all I ask.
Well, this has been a great conversation. Three Dreamers is out the end of April.
A week from today, actually, the 27th.
So by the time this comes out, it will be available on shelves. Go get it. It's a good gift, I think, for Mother's Day. It's a good read for whenever. Go to your library, pick it up, and we can't wait to see what comes next.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
So once again, this was Jessica. Our guest was
Lorenzo Carcaterra.
And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.